Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Rush hour is so frustrating. Think about the time, money, and energy you're wasting just getting to the office. So here's a solution. With GoToMyPC, you can access your office PC from home or anywhere. GoToMyPC, brought to you by Citrix, is the award-winning remote access service. Instantly access your programs, files, emails, and even network resources. All you need is an internet connection. It's so easy to get started. No hardware, just a quick automatic setup. In fact, we just used that for a recent town hall meeting that we had. It worked great. I love it. Great, great product. Go to MyPC. In fact, you could try it for yourself for free. That's right, for free. You must visit gotomypc.com/podcast. That's gotomypc.com/podcast for your free 30-day trial. This podcast is also brought to you by audible.com, the internet's leading provider of spoken word entertainment. Get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today. Log on to audiblepodcast.com/investor. And welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast, episode number 109. It's middle of May, or first part of May, I guess, and we are continuing with this rampant, absolutely just never seen in modern day before rally of the stock market on less than encouraging fundamentals and green shoots, as they say, that are starting to sprout up all around on the economic front. A lot of questions being asked of whether or not this rally is real. Well, of course it's real. It's happening. But the real question is, can it be sustained? What would break the back of this rally? And if it doesn't even break, where does it go from here? Do we see another doubling of where we have from here, just way back all the way, another 30, 20, 50% from here? Or do we see a gradual kind of just a simple kind of leveling off for a while and catching their breath once we see past the stress test, which I want to talk to you about, past the stress tests and kind of past where we've seen the junkiest of issues get blown up and the highest quality with the best fundamental stocks just get left in the dust. So a lot going on right now. We have some great guests on today. I thought that I would bring to you Bill Fleckenstein again. He writes the Contrarian Chronicles. I thought he would be somebody to talk to briefly. But first, we're going to bring you a gentleman who I think will get us some good information regarding the area of commodities. And that's going to be somebody from Indiana Grain Company, Michael Esney. And he knows about commodities, grains and corn and beans and all sorts of fun things. So we'll get to him in a second. And I just wanted to go over a couple of different things. First of all, I will be live on the moneyshow.com website, 9 o'clock. I believe it's on Wednesday evening coming up, just in a few days. And don't forget to log into that. We'll have some updates on the disciplinedinvestor.com, so you can check that out. And I'll be at the Money Show in Vegas, actually, talking about some really cool things and meeting some great people. It's a great opportunity because I get to meet some really great people in the business and really understand and try to understand what they're thinking these days. And that's always really special because you get so many mixed opinions, and that's what makes this whole market go around, right? An understanding of what's happening from a global perspective, what's happening on a regional perspective. You know, we're seeing really high unemployment beyond unbelievable levels in, let's say, Michigan and the Midwest, but yet somehow we're seeing not as bad in some other states around the country. But yet, when you mix it all up, we know we're at, what, an 8.9% right now on the BLS number. Some say we're as high as close to about 16% when you consider the real number, the U6 number, I believe it's called, for unemployment, because you consider all the people that are discouraged and not looking anymore, et cetera, where the BLS kind of shakes out a different number. We saw this week a 539,000 job loss, which was applauded dramatically. And without getting into too much of odd theory here about that, it would seem like in the beginning of the week, we knew at least that we'd see a better number when it came to that? And because when you saw the Fed push the stress test up to Thursday, why would they do that? It was supposed to be Monday. They had all this time to release the information. Why were they going to push it up till Thursday, I wondered. Then I realized, you know what? Maybe the number coming out on an unemployment rate, as well as initial claims and continuing claims, maybe they won't be so bad this week. Maybe we'll see something a little bit better, and they can kind of present the information from the stress test, the official, not the leaks now, the official stress test results. Maybe they'll present it on Friday, and if they can kind of surround it by a better-than-expected unemployment rate. And I wondered how that would happen. You know, that was just kind of, you know, I was thinking about that maybe possible. But how would that actually happen, I wondered. And you know what? I realized what it was after the fact. How did they come out with a 539,000 number versus what has been going on is the mid-sixes? They revised up by the last number, by the way, to 699. Well, they came up with that because they had about 72,000 of new employees by the federal government recently that are going to be temporary employees for the census. Magically overnight, magical hiring to push that number down. Now, I don't know what will happen when we see revisions next week, next month, but it would sure seem to me that without those temporary hirings, we'd still be in somewhere about the 600,000 plus range of jobs that were lost for the period. So an 8.9 rate is the highest since we saw since 1983. Question is going to be, what is that going to mean? We need about 125,000 jobs on a monthly basis just to break even, because that's what all the new people that are coming into the country and the, you know, immigrating in. So that means that those are the amount of jobs we need to have so that the unemployment rate overall for the population growth stays constant. So you have to wonder, what do we have to do now to keep that unemployment rate down and to make President Obama good on his word to save or create 4 to 5 million jobs? Right now, we are going to look like we're going to peak out at 10% by the end of the year, hella high water, no matter what happens, unless there's just a giant, you know, hiring that goes on across the board. But more and more, we're seeing retail starting to lay off, and we're seeing also the service sector paring down. And, of course, don't forget about with Chrysler and impending bankruptcy for General Motors, we have to question what's going to happen with the supply line. I want to give you a couple of ideas and talk to you about a couple of things. I tell you, I have been fighting the tape. It's something I want to talk about for a second. We've been fighting the tape because, you know, we had a great year last year, and we stayed away from a lot of the head fakes, the problems. We made some nice money. This year, in the beginning of this year, we made some nice money. And then, you know, we kind of fought the tape because a lot of the fundamentals and underlying factors when it comes to looking at what is a quality stock, forget the economy, forget the, you know, the fundamentals of the market itself, which we could talk about. But individually, stocks still had a lot of problems. We still see, you know, 10% moves on a stock in a day. Last week, we saw some just unbelievable numbers. Watson Wyatt, WW, is a symbol as an example. I mean, dropped off a cliff last week. They're a consulting firm, and they do a lot of business in Europe. But, you know, that contributed to the problems with the firm. But they just dropped off a cliff. I mean, down 20-something percent, and we saw this consistently. But then on the other hand, we see stocks that are just beating analyst expectations. By the way, we're seeing about a 10% beat on EPS across the board, excluding financials, you know, across the board when it comes to the overall stock market this period. Analysts had clearly undercut. If you remember, we had that professor on a few months ago that talked about how during the tough times, the analysts undercut, and in the good times, they overestimate. So right now, we're seeing the ramifications of, you know, estimates that had been too low. But still, when you look at the free fall, we're seeing the next three quarters of about 25% additional slowdown on stocks. And I think that retail has gotten ahead of itself. We actually went in and shorted Joseph A. Banks. We shorted Abercrombie. We also looked at Hot Topic, which we did not short, unfortunately. We looked to short them because we felt that Hot Topic's numbers, if you look at their sales, if you look at their earnings, if you look at everything about them, they got ahead of themselves. In addition, one of the big reasons was the movie Twilight came out, and a lot of people were looking at the goth kind of setup and buying those type of clothes and to kind of get along in the spirit of the movie as something that they want to do. But unfortunately, that's a short-term situation. Hot Topic fell off a cliff. Take a look at that chart. HOTT is the symbol. But some of the things that we really like right now, you know, if we are in fact in a recovery stage, if we are in a recovery stage, what we will see next is very, very simple. You can never tell, by the way, the beginnings of the recovery, you know, stage one, because you don't know if you're there yet. Stage two, if you're there, it's a lot easier to kind of have the playbook and play out, okay? Here's how it goes. Very simple. You have the industrials, energies, and you have your material companies really starting to play up a little bit more. You have all those early cycle kind of companies starting to come back, and that's what we're seeing. We're seeing energy pick up, and we could talk about that at length, but I hope that oil doesn't get ahead of itself in the 60s and 70s. That would put a real crimp on our economy and could be the reason for another double dip here if we are in upward spike and are recovering. Again, a lot of ifs here. At the same time, when you look at the retails, those are usually in consumer consumer cyclicals and consumer discretionary in particular, you're seeing the restaurants have an enormous rally. I mean, somebody said recently that casual dining today is like the internet companies in 1999. I mean, think about that. There is like an incredible bubble. How during one of the greatest and lengthiest recessions of time, how have these casual dining restaurants do it? Well, it's very simple. They let people go. That's been the big, big claim to fame right now. There was a lot of people let go. And if you think about this, I think I mentioned this before. I wrote about this at least recently. If you think about the math behind the unemployment situation, if you consider that each employee is about $50,000 per year when you consider the total benefit package of an employee on average, and then you consider 100,000 layoffs per week, just add it up. You have like, I think it's $5 billion per week, again, plus or minus, depending on the actual benefit package and pension package and employment package they had. But $5 billion a week of savings for companies overall. So the ability for them to take down their expenses fast is remarkable. That's why we're seeing revenue shortfalls, but earnings beats. We're seeing that they're shortfall on revenue expectations, these companies across the board, or I should say generally, I mean 80%, 85% revenue shortfalls, but magically they're beating EPS because they have slashed their expenses in terms of employees. That is one of the biggest ticket items they have. They have slashed their CapEx expenditures. They have slashed their production and requirement for inventory builds. We saw that. And last week, by the way, on Friday, we saw a really concerning number. We saw inventory builds very low, but we also saw sales on the wholesale level down, I think it was 2.6% from last period. That is not a sign of recovery in the manufacturing and in the wholesale inventories, even though it's not looked at as other ones that we've seen in economic indicators. That is important to question whether or not we're in a recovery phase or not. Are the manufacturers starting to rebuild? One of the things they talked about with GDP would rebuild, and we see a positive GDP in the next, not this quarter, but the following quarter, if we see inventory start to move again. Again, we're not seeing that so far. April number will be key here. So companies are able to slash their costs dramatically, and that has helped them to save money, and therefore that has helped them to really show a great EPS right now. Again, it's a comparative game that we're playing here. But anyway, what you have here is if we are in the second phase, I want you to take a look at like the material sector, the back to the consumer staples again, the material sector, the energy sector. Look at those, and if we are in a recovery phase, those should be the next basic companies, basic materials, that should rocket up from here. So we are busy building that into our portfolios right now. And again, we're very careful that if we do see any kind of concerning levels, we are going to pull back, not take it on the chin and just stay forever. But we reload again and again and again. It has hurt us a little bit using sell stops right now, the disciplines that we use on a consistent basis to save us, because you know we're in a one-directional market right now. But I'll share one other thing for you that I want you to consider. I want you to watch the volume again. We're seeing volume be very lackluster even into this rally. You would think that this gigantic, enormous rally would have to be a tremendous volume event. In other words, participation being very, very high. It's not there. It's not. Volume has been consistently just fading lower and lower. But you know when it was really large? Thursday of last week, the day we saw the 1.5% downstroke on the markets, volume peaked out. That's concerning. One last thing I want to bring up here is that, you know, when we watch what's gone on of late, there's a lot of things we could say that have been going great. You know, we're seeing some clear and absolute demonstrations of of taking a hold by our administration, taking hold of the situation and doing their best to try, at least, to solve some of the problems. They're big and deep problems. I mean, real estate, commercial real estate, foreclosures, delinquencies, big, big, big problem. Banks not lending, big, big problem. Credit card issues, big problem. We have a lot of problems that are really gigantic. You know, again, much of what's happening right now is we're not seeing as bad of a problem. We're just seeing things starting to level off a little bit, not get any worse. That's what's piquing the interest of investors. I don't know whether or not that's exciting or not, because I have my opinions, and I'm going to probably wait a couple more weeks to see where we play out here, because you know, right now it's a knee-jerk reaction to what we saw, a knee-jerk reaction in February, March. But what's interesting to note is what happened on Friday. First of all, let's back it up. On Thursday or so, we saw the leaks, the amazing leaks of data come from our administration, from the Fed. It was no accident, these leaks. These were purposefully done. Let's admit that. They came out every hour or so that this bank didn't need money, this bank needed a little bit. What first happened was Bank of America came out with a $34 billion requirement. This leaked into the New York Times, and the New York Times played the story. The futures were down dramatically, and all of a sudden somebody came and said, oh, well, really, that's not the case. Yeah, they need this, but they could use their preferred stock to convert. They're going to use some other things, et cetera. Not as bad as you think. Markets turned around dramatically. How? Well, it's only $34 billion, I guess. That can be taken care of by dilution of the shares of the common from the preferred. Okay, let's move beyond that for a second. Let's also move beyond my absolute disgust. I had a conversation with Frank Curzio from thestreet.com. I was on his podcast last week. And disappointment and disgust about the leaks. That's just not the way to do business. In a way, if that was done by a company, they would be on charges by the SEC. But basically, the government was seemingly testing the waters to see what people thought, what things were going right with what they had discovered, and trying to retrofit the situation as best as possible on the fly. But the thing that was most disturbing was a Wall Street Journal article. I'll link for this. You need to see this. I'll link to this in the show notes of this episode over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. The most disturbing thing was that the last minute, there was a change. There was negotiations that went on. Now, I don't know how the banks get to negotiate this stuff, because the Fed was supposed to be doing very hardcore stress tests. Whether or not we thought they were hardcore or not, listen to this. What they did was, at the last minute, they changed just one line item, one item, and said, you know, we're going to allow you to use some of your future earnings to offset some of the requirements because, you know, we see what, you know, how future earnings can help. But again, that's projections. That's not what I would call a stress test in terms of making it the worst case scenario, because they're making it very rosy when they look at the earnings situation. But here's what the kicker is. They knocked $110 billion off of the stressful number. So it came out to $74 billion. It was $184 billion of required capital infusion at this time that miraculously disappeared with just a snap of a finger, with just a stroke of a pen. That's horrible. That's not the same information that we found out when the stress tests were released, was it? No. That was not part of the original calculation. So all the companies that were coming out, as a matter of fact, we put out who we believe the Tier 1 and the Tangible Common Equity TCE numbers would probably mean, and what companies would probably be the greatest effect, have the greatest effect, and who would be required to kick in money. And what's amazing is that what we found out, what the numbers that leaked out were, and the numbers that were confirmed the next day, they didn't show us the actual numbers that really would have happened in the stress test before the negotiations and before this one-line change. So I'm going to put that on the site. I want you to check that out and comment back to me. Please do me a favor. Comment on the site. Go over to the Discipline Investor and tell me what you think. Maybe, am I just nuts? I'm just saying I'm being too harsh and critical of the situation. I just want to know the truth. I think it's reasonable as an investor to know the truth. Is it this or is it that? And I know that maybe I'm being, I don't want to say naive, but maybe being too wishful in thinking that our government would be forthright with us. But you know what? It's about time that they do so. All right, I'm off that point. So let's just summarize that the rally, for real or not, I don't know. We'll see very shortly. It's definitely for real because it's where it is and where it's going, and it's here. Will it hold? We'll have to see in the next couple of weeks, because there's going to be some critical time. I will tell you some of my key statistics that look at market peaks have all peaked out. And I'm pretty surprised about that. They peaked out just last week, the latter part of last week. I think I mentioned that to you last week. We'll see a little bit of a kind of a rollover from here and a pause. They're all peaked out and they've stayed there, number one. Number two, Many of the sentiment indicators that you look at are also all peaked out. I put one on the site as well. There's a chart about that shows that. It came out last week under the Sunday Fun column. And I think you should look at that. The other thing is that if we are, in fact, in a recovery phase, we're going to see certain sectors do very well, and those sectors have a tremendous amount of opportunity to run from here. So I want you to check that out. And we are short retail. That's the other thing I mentioned. We'll be very careful into the retail numbers this week as to whether we hold them or not. We have some very nice gains already from them. Take a look at the Joseph A. Banks chart, who a company that gives away 2-for-1, 3-for-1 suits, for that matter. And interesting how they have done so well in this market and environment. Interesting for a lot of different reasons, but question whether they're overdone at this point. All right, when we get back, we're going to talk to our friend, the commodity expert. I think it's going to be good. We're going to get Michael on. And I want you to just hear one thing about Audible.com. You know, you can get my book, a free copy of my book, over at Audible.com. And truthfully, I think that Audible.com is great. They're sponsoring today's podcast. As they, as you know, probably they are the leading provider in spoken word entertainment, audiobooks. They have like 35,000 titles you can choose from and download it and play it back on your, you know, in your car. You can crush it to a CD. You can, you know, it's just really awesome. You can play it back anywhere, just like you play back the Disciplined Investor on your MP3 player. So you just simply go over to audiblepodcast.com/investor. You just sign up for a free trial. You can get a free audiobook download of your choice. You can get mine. The Disciplined Investor is on there, and it comes with a separate page of charts and inserts that you can kind of follow along. And go right there. And I got to tell you something. It is a great, great service. If you love podcasts, you're going to love books that you can just download so easily, audiobooks, just from Audible. So just go to audiblepodcast.com. It's audiblepodcast.com/investor. I get credit for it, so make sure you do it so they stay a sponsor. Do me a favor and get your free audiobook. Just download mine. It's really easy. And just you can browse, you know, whether it's business or it's fiction or nonfiction, or you could read anything you want. What a great experience over at Audible. Really, just great stuff. So check it out, audiblepodcast.com/investor. And you know what? I thought it would be really great if we brought up somebody into the discussion that had a little bit of a different take on things. I thought we'd talk commodities for a little while today. Way back, we had a good man named Thomas Grisafi from Indiana Grain Company. And today, we have Michael Essany from the same company, because these guys know what they're doing and they could trade like the best of them. So, Michael, how are you, buddy?
I'm great, Andrew. It's good to be with you.
Hey, listen, let's talk some commodities, okay?
Okay, it's on our minds here in Indiana. We've got some corn planting problems.
Oh, you know what? Let's just say that I want to make this clear that Tom promised if I ever got there that I can ride a combine.
You know, if you come down to Valparaiso, we could make that dream a reality.
All right, good. I'm encouraged, because, I mean, who doesn't want to, you know, get one of those big old things and start scraping the earth? What's going on with corn? Tell me what's going on.
Well, for the last 5 years, by this point in May, we've had statewide about 40 to 50% of corn planted, and we are approximately at about 5 to 7% of planting this year. Weather, sogginess has been a big issue, and I'm hearing that corn planting issues are scattered about the country, and I think the commodity markets are reacting to that. We've seen corn steadily inching upward. It's going to be an interesting summer for commodities, and I don't want to use Indiana as the microcosm for all that is corn, but it could foreshadow the story to come.
Well, you know, the problem with corn, let's kind of talk about that, because corn does a lot of things. Now, do we think corn maybe has the situation you're describing here has anything to do with ethanol?
Absolutely. There's a lot of companies hoping that this administration will be a friend to ethanol, will be a friend to biofuels, and there's reason perhaps to follow along those lines, but we have to put into perspective where we were last year. Last summer, we had corn touching on $8 a bushel. Mm-hmm. Beans were similarly skyrocketing. There's a whole lot of issues going on with wheat last year. So I think there's this ramp-up period that a lot of folks still haven't come down from yet. And I don't know how much of that psychology is playing into the markets right now, but we have to look at the psychology as much as we have to look at what's really transpiring out in the fields. And it's difficult to say where we'll be.
Well, where's corn now? What's the price of corn now?
corn reached $4.20 a bushel today, and it backed off a little before the close. I think it's right around the 410 mark.
So, and what's the traditional long-term price of corn, you know, generally speaking?
Well, for 50 years, I mean, we traded about $2 a bushel.
Right.
And looking to the future, it's really anybody's guess. There's a you use the key word, the buzzword is ethanol. And will corn be used as the fuel of the future? Some say yes, some say no. There's certainly no shortage of passion on either side of that argument.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's really difficult to say where we're going. Andrew, I would not be shocked if corn saw $7 or $8 again. It's probably not going to happen this summer.
Well, wait a minute. You just mentioned that there's only 5% planted at this point when
in
you should
Indiana.
Have 40 to 50. In Indiana? Okay.
In
so,
Indiana.
All right. So what about
yeah.
the rest? You have any feel on the rest of the country?
I know there are problems, and I think the markets are reacting to those problems. How deep and how, you know, you could have a problem that's a mile long but only an inch deep or the other way around, and it's way too early to make those calls. We won't really know until we get into the summer a little bit more. Probably when we get the actual in June, we'll have a good feel for it. And either way, I think it's going to be a very exciting summer for commodities.
Okay, so let's actually take corn, because a lot of people, I think a lot of my listeners don't have a real good depth when it comes to commodities. It's not the first thing that people look at the, you know, stocks, mutual funds, ETFs, things like that. So let's talk about corn just for a moment more. So now corn we have for ethanol, but corn also is one of the main feeds for the poultry industry.
Absolutely.
So now if
Absolutely.
We kind of take that to the next stage, the poultry industry has a higher price for corn, which then turns into a higher price for poultry, which then, again, another commodity now, kind of up the food chain, if you will, is now priced at a higher level.
Absolutely.
So, or farmers make less money, depending on how you want to look at it. But my bet is that it will cost more for the chicken, okay?
We saw that relationship. We saw the relationship with poultry and meat and commodities earlier this month with the swine flu hike. We saw how commodities began to appear as though they were going to crash. Corn, which had been inching upward, came back down to that 370, 380 level, and now, of course, we're 30, 40, 50 cents higher once the panic slowed down. So the meats and poultry definitely illustrated the importance of corn and the impact it has on the entire market. You're absolutely right.
So there was some interesting discussion about beef. I was just reading that I guess because of the what do they call it here? The development of India. Now this was a little weird because, or maybe it was China. It was China. It wasn't India, because India, I think, are vegetarians for the most part, or many in that area. So now let's talk about China. There was a discussion about how the more China becomes developed, the higher the chance, the higher probability is for meat prices to go up. And that was, they compared it, strangely enough, to copper. And how copper, when China got a taste for copper, prices went through the roof. And the same thing may be happening for beef. Now, just to give one step back on this, I know this is kind of, I don't know, maybe some people think it's exciting, some people don't, but what's the main feed and what goes into producing beef?
You're looking at grains.
Still
you're
grain,
looking
yeah.
at, yeah, you're lo- and you're looking at a scenario where China is becoming a bigger superpower than we realize and could do more than just, I think, heavily influence where the markets are moving. I think we're going to come to a point very soon, although the exchanges won't tell you this, where the futures markets, particularly in the grains, trade 24/7.
Oh, boy.
And I personally, I think it's an inevitability, and it's going to change the way people and traders do business. Now, I have to say, I'm a relative newcomer to the business compared to some of the people I run into at the Board of Trade, some of the people that I work with. I'm 26 years old. However, mm-hmm. being involved in the markets for the last few years, I've come to see how it is a new man or a new woman's game. So that a newcomer who understands the new market dynamics, the new market relationships, almost has the same level of expertise, or perhaps I should say familiarity or advantage, as a broker who's been in the pit for 40 years.
Well, there's a difference between electronic trading and day trading, electronic trading, computer trading with stocks versus it was calling your broker on the phone. That's one big issue.
Absolutely.
The second issue is the amount of caffeine that you'll be intaking compared to maybe some of the other people out there.
And because blood pressure pills, yeah.
Yeah. One of the things, I'll tell you, one of the things that we've made a conscious effort not to do was to trade in the futures markets. And particularly in the Forex markets, you know, they're open essentially 24 hours. I mean, well, you know, there's a little break here and there. But, I mean, that you need time to sleep. You need time to rest every once in a while. And there's plenty of opportunity during an eight-hour day. The problem with the 24-hour commodity market would seem to me that there's some real fear going into going to sleep, seriously, with an open position, I should say.
Oh, absolutely.
Because it's one thing, you know, where something can happen, you wake up and everybody's on the same playing field. It's another thing when, during the night, as you're sleeping, somebody's moving the price on you.
Yeah,
wow.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the things that makes a guy like Tom Grisafi a good trader, is that he stays informed of the markets 24/7, even while he is sleeping. I mean, here's a guy, and I'm sure this is becoming more prevalent, that essentially goes to sleep with a computer and four monitors as close to him on the left as his wife is to him on the right.
Oh, he must be a real pleasure.
And you're absolutely right that it has changed the game, and going to sleep can become a very, very risky endeavor, almost as risky as trading big without stop. It's the same theory.
I have a confession.
Yeah.
I don't go to bed with a computer and four monitors, but I do go to bed with my iPhone right next to me, which gives me constant updates as often as I want with Bloomberg. No kidding. I get the commodity prices, I'll get Forex, I'll get stock, or at least, you know, foreign, and by the way, I believe they're live on that, on the index, you know, on the actual, you know, whether it's Nikkei or the Hang Seng or whatever, but it is a pretty, it's on one hand, it's great, on the other hand, it's sick. I mean, it's a problem, yeah. You know, because unfortunately, we need to keep up with these things. They're moving so quickly, and particularly in this time. So let me go through a couple of things that I find interesting. What is what's your favorite commodity to trade?
Oh, I'm a lover of corn and beans. They're fascinating to me. They're fun to watch. Corn is, I don't want to say an easier trade. It's a slower moving commodity, less volatility, less price action than with beans, which can obviously explode 20, 30 cents either direction on a dime. Corn is a little slower. Some might argue that case last summer, but it is now. So those are probably my preferential commodities.
And how much money do you have in a trade? So let's talk about a trade. So you hit for one contract of corn. How much money is that?
How much money? You mean as far as trading with margin?
No. How are you gonna hit? You can hit a contract, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And what is the value of a contract?
Oh, okay. You're talking with the price of corn as it is now.
Yeah, $5. Corn is $5. How much?
Right. You're looking at $25,000.
$25,000. So every time you hit click, 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 $25,000.
Yeah.
And therefore, if it moves, whatever it moves, it's a percentage game, of course. It moves a little bit this way, moves this way, depends on how much it is. And it's fully liquid. Okay, so fine. So
well, one tick on a one lot is $13.
$13 for one tick. Okay, so you just got a little thing go ching, 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 or oh my God, depending on how you want to look at it. So,
yeah.
And you could trade baskets, I'm sure. You could trade a variety of different ones at one time. You have different computers. Mm-hmm. Not much different than a level two, I assume, for a stock trader.
Right.
Okay. And are there any ETFs that you would buy? Like we like DBA, DBO, DBC, UCF, UCO, USO, excuse me. Are there any of those ETFs or closed end that you trade in terms of commodities?
I really don't. I'm a screen trader. I like to watch the dynamics between individual commodities within the market and react in the present, in the moment. Because I will tell you that market sensitivity, as you know, is, I don't want to say at an all-time high. It certainly was more so several months ago. But trading with the news is every bit as important, and I dare I say more important, than looking at the charts, looking at fundamentals, because so many things can move individual entities within the market, whether you're trading stocks or commodities, that it's almost impossible to sit in a room by yourself with just a laptop and a few tickets open on your trading software and think that you can trade from an informed standpoint. I mean, at this rate, I'm really surprised that the pits still exist. I know it's a dwindling population down there, but it has changed so much that I think we're only at the cusp of the change that's ahead of us. That's actually something that I was thinking of particularly today, and I was going to ask you if you don't mind me asking this question. But I could almost envision a time with, for example, this discussion that's going on now in the state of California about legalizing marijuana. This could be something that is ultimately traded on an exchange. Can you see a time when that happens?
So when they call that, they say that the prices of pot are really high, they're not kidding.
Right.
I mean, I guess so. I mean, I got to tell you something. That is an interesting thing that you bring up there. You know, right now there's, I think it's, is it Seattle or is it Northern California, where there's a town that specializes in pot and marijuana, you know, sales and all that. They kind of let it go, and it's good for the economy and all that. I got to tell you something. I don't even know. I'm not a prude. I'm not even talking about what the effects would be. I don't even know what to say. That would be just mind-boggling to me. But yeah, it could be traded, I guess, like that. You know, you got to. It's a commodity. It's a plant. It's like anything else. It's like a vegetable, if you will, or any kind of other commodity that you're gonna be trading. That would be kind of strange, though.
Absolutely. It would be very peculiar. But I could see how things are changing so much, where a scenario like that is plausible, if not probable.
Well, and you trade potatoes. You could trade potatoes theoretically, and that makes up maybe vodka, for example, or you have other different ingredients that make up foods and all that. So let me ask you a couple of things about commodities, because I think that one of the things that we're looking at is that when we look at the CRB commodity index, you know, basically the pricing, it just moved up nicely, finally, after basing out after all this time. And I think that it's my impression, and what we're looking at is we waited till we saw any significant bottoming of that, until we invested in some of the commodity materials and some of the stocks and the companies that are involved in that area. For example, you know, we really didn't want, when there was no demand for food products or any kind of commodity, and there was no consumption going on, my idea is that, you know, there's still a recession going on. There's still some kind of a slowdown going on. Okay. Now, yeah, it doesn't mean that it's over as soon as that picks up. But you know what? When we see demand increasing, that's a good sign that something's happening. And whether it's because of a, you know, manufacturing issue or consumption individually for eating or for use. And, you know, we started buying things like Moo, which is an ETF that deals with agricultural. MOO. We bought things like, for example, we bought some of the ETFs that trade in the area of that. We also have things like Mosaic, against my better will, because I'd be on better judgment, because, you know, the fundamentals are not showing us anything with Mosaic, by the way, you know, fertilizer and potash, etc. And in terms of the commodities, I mean, are you truly seeing a pickup in the prices due to demand over a pickup in prices from trading, or just a pickup in prices because of maybe like the corn situation where there wasn't enough planted? There's a difference there, right?
There's an enormous difference. I think a little bit of everything that you just said is correct, but you have to keep in mind that no matter what happens in the world, people aren't going to stop eating. And I think you're finding investors and traders in particular coming to this realization that no longer sees, for example, commodities exploding or precipitously declining with the energy trade. Crude and corn aren't really related anymore. Last summer, they certainly were.
Right.
So there's a multitude of factors, but I think it comes to the burgeoning realization of just how important commodities are to the sustenance of both the developed and the developing worlds.
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, when we come to the food commodities, but let's talk about oil. Is oil, as we become more energy efficient, going to lose its, you know, is it going to lose some of its trading abilities, or is it to stay constant?
I think it's going to lose some of its luster. I certainly do think it's going to trade higher. I think the energies are in for somewhat of a bullish run. I'm not going to be arrogant or ignorant enough to predict that we're going to see $150 or $200 a barrel of crude oil. But I do think we're going to continue to see net gas and crude oil inch upward, and I think that could have profound effects on the marketplace as a whole. It's something that could affect stocks. It's something that, you know, could ultimately impact potash or agrium or a host of other stocks or indices, and it's something to certainly look at. But at the same time, we're inching toward that $60 a barrel level right now. And I can tell you from the people that I talk to, other traders in particular, that the next big move is not necessarily clear. Are we going to go to 65 or 70, or are we going to somehow end up back to 40? Much of this speaks to the economy, the broader spectrum of the economy, and if a recovery is underway, then the safe bet would be that energies are going to go higher.
Mm-hmm.
But that could still be unrelated to commodities. It's a very, very difficult dynamic, and you really have to look at individual factors more than the relationship between those two.
Well, but when it comes to oil, you know, you're familiar with the contango trade, right?
Yes.
Can you, in your best, put your 11th grade teacher's hat on?
Explanation of it?
Tell us what exactly is backwardization and contango.
Well, it's when the futures price several months out is considerably higher than the spot price, meaning the price we're at right now.
Mm-hmm.
So you could, for example, for market conditions that are presently not perceptible, you could have a futures contract for crude oil trading at $100 a barrel, whereas today we're looking at half that price. That, in layman's terms, is contango.
So so what's happening is, and our understanding of this is that because there is a spread, and let's just use some easy numbers, let's say 50 and 60. $50 mm-hmm. what it costs now, and a few months from now, the futures are 60. Isn't it normal? It's not normally to have that, is it?
No. And we're seeing variances as well in soybeans, for example. Almost the reversal. There was I think it was $1.40 or $1.50 difference the other day between July and November soybeans. But you have to keep in mind, soybeans have had a lot of issues. There's been some weather problems out of Argentina, and beans have had a problem. So you're seeing across the board a dramatic difference between futures prices and spot prices. It really makes trading more volatile and a little more difficult to get a firm grip on.
Mm-hmm. So when you have this contango situation, what's happening now, as I see it, is the big boys, what they're doing is taking oil because they could sell it again. They could buy it today at 50 and sell it to somebody else at 60. The $10 spread is great, but the problem is they have to take delivery now. So what they're doing is they have these great big container ships, and they're littering up the various oceans and seas around the world with these filled cargo ships filled with oil and just floating around, and they're basically saying that if we can do this on, let's say, a three-month basis, well, it makes sense. The cost of the ship, the cost of storing it, and then the eventual sale is no problem. We have no problem with that. But at the same time, we're also seeing tremendous amount of inventory builds on a weekly basis, you know, 3 million barrels per week of build, which is enormous, absolutely enormous. And it's also interesting that we're having this, we're having prices go up, and OPEC's not reducing down production. It's just an amazing situation that's happening. At least I see it this way.
And absolutely. But I think we're going to see a lesser amount of oil being stored out in the seas because of potential pirate attacks. So I could see that scaling back that plan right away.
Right. Exactly. So pirates aside, which is kind of interesting, don't we have with oil, because of all of this, don't we have an enormous backlog of oil between floating around and stockpiled so that it puts a lid on the possible price, even though consumption may increase over the summer?
The stockpiles are very mysterious. It's not exactly clear to me how that all works. And I think what you saw under the last year of the Bush administration with stockpile as much as you can, and then if there's not enough room for more, build more facilities to continue stockpiling. There is a pervasive fear that I think will linger on for a great while that this energy crisis isn't going to go anywhere. And before we find some great biofuel alternative, and I personally don't see ethanol as that long-term solution, I think sooner rather than later, certainly in our lifetime, you're going to see the price of crude oil explode. And the reserves you see being stockpiled now will be that buffer for that transition period. And hopefully it will be a gradual incline and not as sudden and impactful as the rush-up we saw last year from 07 to the summer of 08. That could be detrimental, specifically with an economy that's trying to recover. But we went from gasoline being the price, being the problem with people traveling and spending money, to crude oil coming down, but then the real problem, people weren't going to work, is because there were no jobs. So now, with some sort of normalcy being restored to the economy, I think those reserves play an important role in pacifying the powers that be and the general public to know that crude purchased at a lower price is at our disposal should a great emergency emerge in the coming months or years.
Mm, interesting. So what I find interesting is that, tell me about the relationship between oil and gas, because somehow that's not been working hand in hand lately, has it?
No, not at all. I mean, in our neck of the woods, for example, gasoline is, I think, about $2.45 at the pump here in the Valparaiso area. And you'll see it, on a percentage basis, go up much higher at the pump than it will with the price per barrel of crude oil. There's a market dynamic there that I don't know if I could necessarily explain, if it's something that I fully understand, but they're not necessarily synonymous. That synergy isn't present. It's certainly also a sign of the oil companies coming to the realization that their golden egg last summer is no more, and they're probably very, very thrilled with the relationship that exists between the price of crude oil and the price of gasoline at the pump. It's a very, very interesting, peculiar situation, but I don't think we'll see $4.50 gas again anytime soon. Perhaps one day we will. But for now, I think the economy is somewhat reassured knowing that we're going to have gas that's in the $2 range.
Right. Yeah. And I think that I really do believe, really, really believe that last summer, or I shouldn't say, yeah, I guess it was last summer entirely, that gas at $4, $4.50, approaching $5, broke the back of the consumers. I've always said that one of the things that you could do, because consumers use gas and they have to pay for it, and they have to pay for it right away. So it's right out of their pocket, right out of their wallet, versus something that they pay in the future, if you will, right? Yes, you can use credit cards, don't get me wrong. But still, paying for gas, $20, $30, $40, $50, $100 a tank, I mean, that puts a crimp into your activity, into your excitement, okay?
Oh, crippling. Absolutely.
And that broke the back. They should have subsidized it immediately. That would have been a much better play to avert a lot of what happened, aside from the whole banking crisis. But, to avert some of that and cause create a more of a softer landing or softer environment. But nonetheless, they didn't listen to me. And that would have been a little difficult by the way. It wouldn't have been fair. Let's also state the fact that if you drive 100 or 200 miles a day to work and, to and from, and I only go 3 miles, it's not quite fair that you're going to get a bigger discount than I am. Although you pay more, but.
I will happily sign a petition for Andrew Horowitz for Energy Czar.
Excellent.
I'll sign that
thank
petition.
You. Oh, thank you. Thank you. And we'll give everybody the address afterwards, okay? So we see commodity prices generally moving higher. What about, let's talk about some of the metals. What are the metals that you like to trade?
Gold, silver. I'm not a gold bug. We read the Gartman letter every day, and even Gartman has had to come to terms with the fact that gold might not be on that upward momentum to 1,200 or 1,400 or 1,600. I've never really followed the lead of those commercials that say, send in your gold or buy it now because it's going to go to 2,000 an ounce. Andrew, I was tempted at one point. I really was. I thought about it right alongside those Nutrisystem commercials that air nonstop on CNBC.
Oh, you're going to love those.
Inflation, I think, is coming, and with the ballooning deficit and while printing all this money, I can't really see much of a way around it. I think the $17 billion cut from the budget this week by President Obama is, I think, 0.5% of the $3.5 trillion budget laid out for the 2010 fiscal year.
It was a big number, but it's not what you think it is.
No, it's symbolism. That's what this. What the
isn't it all?
Is
hasn't it all been so far symbolism and posturing?
Symbolism and posturing do have its place in American politics, specifically when it comes to trying to restore some measure of confidence. Granted, you can't just have confidence without correcting a broken model. They go hand in hand. But for right now, I think the reason that President Obama's polls suggest that he's still somewhat acceptable to the American people is because he is illustrating progressive steps forward. Whether or not you agree with those steps, he's mm-hmm. doing something. Mm-hmm. And that's generally been the public reaction so far.
Yeah.
But getting back to your question about gold, I could see it inching higher, but I don't think I think sometimes it's a great scalp. And
yeah.
Other than that, I never have any long-term positions on in the metals because it could go one way or another, but I'm not bold up to the upside, not by any stretch of the imagination.
And Gartman, listen, Gartman's been right, and he's been wrong, let's be honest. I mean, you know, he's a smart fellow. He's been very excited about copper. You know, China's been bulking up copper. Here's the thing that, you know, of course, you know, it's hard to find exactly where things are happening. So how would you find out? Let me ask you this. So how would you find out what the inside rap is on copper? I mean, who's buying it? You know, what would you do to investigate that circumstance?
Well, you know, it's funny you ask this question because I have been pondering for some time how to streamline all of the sources of information that I get as a trader.
Mm-hmm.
I'm whether the news is coming from Bloomberg or Gartman or a host of other resources that I subscribe to, you really have to mix and match information to try to get sort of a calculated understanding of who's buying what and what's driving the marketplace. One of the things I've always wanted to do and probably will aim to do is start some sort of a grain-related morning squawk service mm-hmm. that kind of coalesces all this information and tells grain traders and metal traders what they need to know, because I think there's no shortage of squawk services out there for stocks,
right.
News, but not for grain. So getting to your question, it confounds me. I'm struggling with it, and I hope, because ultimately great entrepreneurial ideas are born of difficult periods,
frustration.
Periods. and I think my own frustration with something along the lines of the question you just posed would make an endeavor like that very successful. So it's actually something, if you were to ask me what's ahead of my plate besides being a trader, it's going to be starting this grain squawk service in the very near future.
Yeah.
Not to self-promote here, Andrew. I apologize for that.
No,
it segued perfectly from your question.
No, I understand. No, that's totally understandable. So tell me some sites that you like to find information on commodities and grains and metals.
Oh, it's a great mix mosh. I mean, you could I read Ag Resource. It's a great newsletter. Gartman, of course, is great. If you have a Bloomberg terminal, that's absolutely phenomenal.
Tell me on the Bloomberg terminal some of the shortcuts that you use for that. And what I'll do is I'll post some of those on the site to give an example of what it looks like.
Oh, well, what I mean by the Bloomberg terminal is the news that comes out.
The commodity news.
The commodity news. I couldn't tell you. I'm not the one sitting there executing
right.
it. I'm just the one absorbing it. It's there. I have found that in the mainstream media, if you can't afford a Bloomberg terminal, if you can't subscribe to these services, I have found that daily periodicals, just in Google News or mm-hmm. price action in copper or anything relating to the precious metals, it's getting so much more coverage. That it has never been easier to find information. It's just calling all of it into one source that mm-hmm. is the real difficult endeavor of it all.
It always is. I mean, it's the old saying that it's like trying to take a sip of water out of an open fire hydrant.
Yeah,
the information's there, but it's tough to kind of corral it. So okay, let's talk about what's your favorite trade coming into this summer. I mean, you mentioned corn. Oil. I mean, what things? We said corn may be long, oil may be long. What do we go in short on?
I'm really reluctant to be short commodities. I would think that we'll have a pretty. Now, I might completely flip on this within a month or two. It depends on where we go. But for right now, I am personally very optimistic about a bullish run in corn, in beans, in wheat, and it's going to be a very very interesting summer to watch. But I would advise anyone to proceed with great caution and look very carefully into where we've been before making an estimation as to where we're going.
Yeah.
Because anything could happen, and we could match last summer's volatility if perfect storm conditions are met.
Mm. Well, that would be very difficult on the economy, because for each move we have on the commodity prices up is additional money out of the consumer's pocket. Not a good time to be involved in that very, very, very fragile environment.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's another reason for my resistance toward the notion of ethanol as the saving grace of our energy crisis, because I think the food versus fuel struggle is something that a lot of people aren't going to give up on, and it's something that could make eating and feeding your family a greater obstacle, and that would be very, very, very sad to watch.
Okay. All right, well, we'll leave it there. Michael Isonet, we'll put some links back to your site. Everybody can check out the Indiana Grain Company. I encourage you to check out the pictures of their trading room. It is quite an extraordinary view, and there's some videos there as well that you want to take a look at. I trust me, you'll enjoy, folks, checking out what's going on with these guys. They're not sitting around on their fannies all day eating bonbons. I'll tell you, they're moving and shaking, and it's really something that you need to take a look at. So, my friend Michael, thank you for joining me today on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
Thank you, Andrew. Appreciate it.
I'll speak to you soon. Hey, we're here with Bill Fleckenstein, and he is a prolific writer, great writer, writes the Contrarian Chronicle for MSN. Also, of course, with Fleckenstein Capital. How are you, Bill?
I'm fine. How are you, Andrew?
Good. So it's been an interesting time. I mean, you have been contrarian on the side of wondering how long this is going to last, if this rally is real, et cetera. So what do you think is going on?
Well, I think what is going on is we have a massive amount of stimulus that is being applied by the Federal Reserve and the United States government in the form of fiscal policy, and that has been in response to the incredible credit bubble that we had, the credit/real estate bubble, which, when it burst, nearly collapsed the financial system. So you've got the two powerful forces lapping up against each other, A, the burst bubble, and B, the governmental response to that. The liquidity has gone to the stock market first. Liquidity oftentimes will spill into certain asset markets. It takes less liquidity to move an asset market than it does to the economy. And so we've seen a response in the stock market to liquidity, and perhaps to people have gotten a little too fearful. So I don't know. There are a lot of bits of conventional wisdom that the market always sees the recovery and all that stuff, and always sees down the road. But quite frankly, the market didn't see the collapse coming, and I'm not sure the market rally means much in the way of improvement for the economy. Mm-hmm. However, after declining at 6% two quarters in a row, even if we're going to grow at -1, it'll look a lot better. So the fact that the data's improved is not very surprising.
Yeah, one of the things that is interesting is, you know, everybody's talking about these green shoots, and the green shoots are really nothing more than the comment of it's not as bad as we thought it was going to be, or it's getting a lot less worse. I'm not sure how much that carries us, but I mean, one of the things that's interesting is that everybody seems to be rushing for the door and getting into the markets these days. Not everybody, I shouldn't say that, but there seems to be this mad rush, and people are all nervous they're going to miss something, when in fact there's plenty of time. And if we do return to some reasonable growth over time, I would think that there's plenty of time to get in the market if that's at a safe point, that is.
Well, you know, that's always hard to know. In hindsight, it's always clearer, but that's the problem is all this money printing that has gone on, and the fact that there's been a little bit better data makes for the potential for lots of head fakes, you know. So I think people just have to be careful about what they do and make sure that they own securities that they understand, they know why they own them, and be prepared and know that there is an unusually large amount of volatility and noise in both data and the marketplace now, simply because of all this huge money printing and the fact that the economy had stopped and now it's growing faster than stopped, but whatever rate, we don't really know.
Mm-hmm. So do you think this is a bullish discussion for generally now for equities, or is this something to still be cautious about? I mean, now we got 30% from the bottom of the barrel here. There's been a lot of question of whether we've had the bottom, whether it's going to test again, but forget that. Is this something that we should be able to trust at this point, at least reasonably?
I don't think you can ever trust asset markets.
Okay.
If you go in and think you can trust an asset market, you let your guard down. I mean, asset markets do not exist to make people money. They exist to take money away from people. Now, once you figure out how the game is played and you get better managing risk, then you can learn how not to lose money. But I think the equity bubble that we had courtesy of Greenspan and the credit and the real estate bubble we had courtesy of Greenspan taught people a lot of bad lessons about, well, you know, just show up and you make all this money and it'll all work out. That's not how it works. So I think that the wreckage that was created at the end of last year created plenty of opportunities, both in credit, whether it was in municipal bonds or in bank loans or in certain stocks, and a lot of assets have rallied. Some have gone too far. Some probably have room to go. But a lot of that depends on how much of this money printing is going to turn into inflation and how much of it's going to turn the crank of the economy. I think we're going to have a lot more inflation than real GDP growth, but I really don't know. So I think that people have to be prepared to be patient. And if you can take risk and you want to and you feel like you have some compelling reason to own certain assets, then fine. But this is not what I would consider to be a low-risk juncture, nor is it the fact that everything is so cheap that all the bad news has been discounted. We're kind of in no man's land, if you ask me.
Well, it's interesting because when you say it's quite the opposite in terms of this rally. It's almost like all the bad news you want to throw at it doesn't matter anymore, and everything is being taken as a positive. But one of the other things that's interesting about this rally, and I don't know if it has anything to do with anything, but is the amount of risky assets that have gone up dramatically, the high beta, the ones with very little earnings, and the low price stocks that have gone up just geometrically, while leaving some of the other quality stocks in the dust. I mean, does that say anything?
Right.
I don't even know what that says.
Well, I mean, a lot of them maybe dropped pretty radically. Maybe there was a huge short interest in some of the names. There's a lot of quantitative trading strategies that are utilized. Those tend to create momentum in both directions. So, I think that mostly the inverse to quality nature of a lot that's transpired in the rally is somewhat alarming, but it doesn't have to be. It's just part of what's gone on. I mean, we have to print this much money and to have the Fed monetize the bond market. That's bad. That's not sound economic policy. Nor is running a $1 trillion plus deficit. So we're committing huge crimes against economic nature, if you will, to ward off the ill effects of the fact that people behaved like lunatics in the real estate bubble, and none of the government regulators did their jobs. So we had a calamity, and now we're bailing it out with insane economic policy, and we've created a big rally in stocks. Well, okay, so maybe stocks are going to go up, but it's not like stocks are super cheap and we've discounted all this bad news, or that the coast is clear. We're following up one bad economic policy with more bad economic policy, hoping that it won't be too awful. You know what I mean? So, but the medicine, i.e. liquidity, tends to make stocks go up. So it makes it kind of tricky to figure out what you're supposed to do. I think in the end, the dollar is going to come under a great deal of pressure. I think interest rates are going to rise. Ultimately, that will be negative for stocks. And the safest thing that I know to do is to own foreign currencies or precious metals, because that's the only outcome that I think is guaranteed.
Well, it's interesting because I think a lot of people are also panicked about this, that they have to be doing something, they have to get into something and making a lot of very, very quick moves. But when it comes to the financial markets now, let's talk about just for a moment about the financials. I've been having this recurring thought about the last week's release of the stress tests, whether or not they were stressful or not. I mean, we're getting both sides of the commentary. One, some people say they weren't stressful at all. Some people say they were very stressful. But how do you feel about how the information was leaked out? That somehow is a real sticking point for me. And not trying to just look for every negative and everything, but there was something rather disturbing, I found at least, about this leaked, almost the hourly leak of information into the public to as a testing ground. Did you find that interesting?
Well, I just think, who knows? It was sort of like the stress test is like you're a student, you're given a test, but you're given the answers at the same time,
right,
so to speak.
Right.
And, they ran the test. People kind of had some idea what was going on. Obviously, the entities that were being stress tested knew what was the results were going to be because, look, three of them filed deals last night, or two of them filed deals last night, right?
Mm-hmm.
That'd be Morgan Stanley and Wells Fargo.
Right.
So, obviously, people knew what was coming, so it was all leaked out, and I don't know, I just trust the idea of a concept of a stress test was a good one. These tests weren't super stressful, that's disappointing. On the other hand, it's part of the flailing process to try to get at how bad things are, so it's a step in the right direction. So it was a messy process, it wasn't very stressful, but it was a step in doing something. So I think that, it was better than doing nothing. Was it perfect? No.
Yeah. In closing, about the financials, there's a couple of different positions out there that have been just confounding me. For example, Capital One, which came out with their earnings a couple of weeks back, and they were abysmal. Their delinquency rates were abysmal. Their numbers across the board were horrifying. They went down to about $14 a share. They're up at like 31 or something like that. This is a credit card company with delinquency rates that are out of control and bringing back, under the FASB ruling, bringing back a $50 billion piece of off-balance sheet financing that they did, and I everything about it is just unbelievable. Meanwhile, they don't need any capital in the stress test, and it looks like they're just the stock is being bid up to the moon again. Can we trust these financials? I haven't been able to put any money in the financials. Okay,
I haven't put money in financial stocks for a decade. They're financial black holes. They were impossible to analyze. They made up all the numbers every step of the way, then they imploded.
Yeah.
Now the taxpayer's been forced to bail them out. And some of the stocks are going up. Capital One's, I think, is potentially a disaster. I think the variables in the stress test weren't severe enough. On the other hand, I used to be short this stock. I was shorted from about 80 until 25 or so last November when I closed my short fund. And now it's up here. I mean, it's just a dangerous stock when to be short, and it's a dangerous stock to own.
Yep.
Somewhere down the road, maybe I'll be shorted again. I mean, I think it's got far bigger problems in front of it than what the stress test showed. But for the moment, you're yelling at the rain.
Yep. It is yelling at the rain. That's what it feels like right now because, and I guess I did say in closing, and I am really going to close on this point. One of the fascinating parts about this and where we kind of bang our head against the desk every once in a while is that fundamental analysis is right now, for the moment, this is maybe a snapshot in time. What's the point? What's the point of analyzing anything right now? Is there any?
You have to know what is really transpiring. Look, markets are always always in a state of flux, and they're either, crazy on one side or the other. You have to know what you think is really going on, and you have to know that there's this massive amount of stimulus being applied,
right.
And you have to give everything wide, any idea you have wide berth. But look, the market didn't discount any of the debacle.
Right.
It missed it all, and all of a sudden it all caved in on itself. Everyone's saying it's just subprime, it's contained. So Wall Street, as it's set up, missed that all. So
mm-hmm.
Now that they're rallying, everyone wants to say, well, the market's telling us things are getting better. Well, the market didn't tell you things were getting bad. So, I don't think fundamental analysis is useless, but you just have to recognize when the government is printing this much money, asset markets sometimes go up.
Yep.
That does not mean the economy will recover, but it probably will make the economy a little bit better as wounded corporations fund themselves. We've had, I don't know, 20, 30, 40, 50 deals in the last couple of weeks, Dow Chemical, all these banks. I mean, companies are raising capital. Well, putting that makes the economy do a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this money's come kind of essentially at its root, come out of thin air by the government, right?
Right.
And so it's going to end up in more inflation, but for the moment, it just makes markets go up.
I hear you. Well, I look forward to you reading your articles. Everybody, you can check out the Contrarian Chronicles over at MSN. We'll put a link on the blog so you can get over there. And I appreciate your time and always enjoy talking to you and reading your work. Bill Fleckenstein from Fleckenstein
Thank
Capital.
You.
Have a good day, buddy.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Bye-bye.
All righty.
And that's going to wrap it up for today. Make sure you check it out, themoneyshow.com. I'll be on again Wednesday evening, 6 p.m. Eastern. Excuse me, 6 p.m. I guess that's Vegas time, so 9 o'clock. And we'll have a replay, hopefully, of that afterwards. But hopefully you'll be in Vegas and I can meet you. So make sure, if you are there, to look me up. Otherwise, we'll have some other things of interest next week. I'm going to bring some more individual positions for you to take a look at, and we have some great guests coming up. Thanks for joining me today on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. We'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.